This is Charudas welcoming you to Bhagavad Gita As It Is study sessions. Today we're in the 17th chapter, which is entitled The Divisions of Faith. This is the second verse, part 2. I'll read the Sanskrit, then the English, then we'll discuss it. Shri Bhagavan Vacha Trividha Bhagavati Shadha Dehinam Sa Sabhavaja Satviki Rajasi Chaiva Tamashi Cheti Tam Shanu. Translation. The Supreme Personality of God had said, according to the modes of material nature acquired by the embodied soul, one's faith can be of three kinds, in goodness, in passion, or in ignorance. Now hear about this. Be back in a moment with discussion. Arjuna's question here is basically what happens to a man who has lots of faith, but that faith is blind or misdirected. A bona fide spiritual master must be thoroughly versed in the scriptures. The Sanskrit word for scripture is shastra. Shastra means to control. The scriptures are meant to control one's life, to put him in the mode of goodness, and in the mode of goodness he becomes eligible to see the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just like in the Bible, you have the Ten Commandments. And someone may say, I'm a good Christian, I follow all the Ten Commandments. It's very commendable that one follows all the Ten Commandments, because hardly anyone does nowadays, especially when you understand the commandment, thou shalt not kill, to include less than human species of life, then hardly anyone follows the Ten Commandments. But let's say you have a man who does strictly follow the Ten Commandments in the spirit in which they are given. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he's seen God. Without following the Ten Commandments, no one can see God. But it doesn't mean that everyone who follows the Ten Commandments can see God. This is the meaning of this statement, is not by works alone that one sees God. The works must be there. There's two extremes here. There's those who say that you don't have to do anything, smoke, drink, and whatever, and if God wants, he'll show himself to you. That's the one extreme. And the other extreme, of course, is that those who say that the more work that you do, then God is forced to show himself to you. Both extremes are wrong. No amount of work that you do will force God to show himself before you. On the other hand, there must be works of devotion. One must follow the rules of the scriptures in order to qualify, in order to make himself eligible for seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I've given this example before. So many men every year are knighted by the Queen of England, and many of those men are common men. They're not all from the aristocracy. So those men who are united are not, in other words, everyone who follows the laws of the country doesn't mean that he's going to be knighted, right? It doesn't mean that just because I go when the light's green and stop when it's red, the Queen's going to come to my house and give me a knighthood. But you can be absolutely sure and certain that she's definitely not going to give a knighthood to someone who doesn't follow the laws of the country. You see the two extremes? Not everyone who follows the laws of the country gets a knighthood. On the other hand, no one who doesn't follow the laws of the country get a knighthood. Those who are going to receive knighthoods will be chosen from the pool of people who follow the laws of the land. Similarly, he who will see the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face in the future is he who is following the rules and regulations of the scriptures. And scriptures are meant to bring one into the mode of goodness. In our last session, we compared ignorance to wood, we compared passion to smoke, and we compared goodness to fire. The end result is fire, is it not? If you want to cook tasty, palatable foodstuffs, You have to get fire. It doesn't mean that just by going down and chopping the wood, your work is finished. First you get wood, then you get smoke, and you get fire. So although wood, smoke, and fire are one in one sense, in another sense they're very different. Because until you get fire, you can't begin to do your business. Similarly, until you give up eating meat, fish and eggs, intoxication, including coffee, tea, and cigarettes, illicit sex, sex outside of marriage, and gambling, then whatever pretensions you have to spiritual life will all be frustrated. Just like, I'll give you an example, if a spark falls on wet grass, it will be extinguished immediately. Similarly, if one is living in the mode of ignorance, what does ignorance mean? It means meat-eating, drug-taking, and sleeping. So such a person, even if he receives the association of a bona fide spiritual master, even if he gets the opportunity to hear the scriptures perfectly delivered, it will bounce off of him. It will find no place in his heart. Just like fire and water are opposites. When they come into contact, fire is immediately extinguished. So similarly, any good fortune of association with spiritual masters or hearing everything explained in a bona fide way will have no effect on him. He will not be able to take advantage of his good fortune. Cast not pearls before swine. It's better that he not even be associated with that. Therefore, one of our rules is that one should not preach to a faithless person. One should not preach to a faithless person. Just like a man, let's say you have a father. Your father's a very fine, upstanding man. But one day you encounter another guy on the street who's drunk and he's saying all kinds of lies about your father. Now the best thing for you to do is just walk right past him and avoid him. If you go up to that person and try to convince him that your father's really a good man, now you might have been able to convince him when he was sober, but when he's drunk, he'll not listen to reason. And any convincing that you try to do will make him more vituperative, will make him more insane in his blasphemy of your father. So if the blasphemy is originally bad and ill-founded and untruthful, and you incite him to even greater heights of blasphemy, then you, in a sense, get some bad karma from doing that. Similarly, those who are in the mode of ignorance, basically, as long as they're in that intoxicated, ignorant state of mind, they shouldn't even be approached. More often than not, when they're approached to impart spiritual knowledge, they become angry. Ubedashoi murkaram prakapayona shantiye. He says, if you give a fool good advice, he becomes angry. So, throughout Bhagavad Gita, the words of Lord Krishna, he's constantly stressing logic and argument, that you should not accept things blindly. If you accept a spiritual leader blindly, then whatever mode of nature that spiritual leader is in, then you will also become entangled in that particular mode of material nature. One has got intellectual powers. He's got a brain in the human form of life. The cats and dogs don't have a brain. They don't have discrimination. But we can discriminate. So if anyone claims to be a bona fide spiritual master, then we have to test his credentials. Take a man who claims to be rich. You can say, well, where's your credit cards? Where's your limousine? Where's your chauffeur? Where's your house in Bel Air? If he can't produce these things, then you don't have to accept that he's rich. You don't have to accept that someone's a spiritual master just because he tells you he is. You have to determine by logic and argument. And then you make your leap of faith. That is the reasoning why we have the discriminative capacity. To sort out all the different opinions, all the different spiritual masters, all the different scriptures, and based on our own intellectual prowess, we have to determine which one is the most elaborate, which one is the most consistent, which one holds the most logical water. And then once we've concluded that, then we have to throw ourselves into it, heart and soul. Then we have to make our leap of faith, as Soren Kierkegaard said. Now there are cynics who say that the search is everything. They don't expect to find anything ever, the search is everything. And generally they teach comparative religion. But by comparative religion, you'll never understand the absolute truth. By licking the outside of a jar of honey, you'll never know what honey tastes like. You have to unscrew the cap and lick inside to taste the honey. Similarly, by licking the outside, you'll never understand what true religion is. So without chanting, without following the regular principles of the scripture, one will not be able to taste. So one owes it to oneself to experiment, not only to bring his intellectual powers to bear upon the Vedic arguments, their logic and reasoning, and to compare it with others, but having once concluded, if one indeed does come to this conclusion, that this is a superior, a more elaborate, sophisticated, airtight philosophy, then he has got to make the next step. Now that will not be a blind step of faith. If he decides to give up eating meat, illicit sex, intoxication, gambling, and to start chanting, that faith is a different kind of a faith than the faith of the dog or the cat. The dog and the cat may have any kind of faith based whimsically. The man, just like your Timothy Leary's, based on an LSD hallucination, he may develop any kind of a faith. He may even say that a pill is God. That kind of a faith in the mode of ignorance is different than the kind of a faith in the mode of goodness, which is bulwarked by reasoning and argument. The one is called a reasonable faith, and the other is called an unreasonable faith. Just like the faith of the modern-day scientists is that everything happened by a Big Bang. It happened by a Big Bang. That's like arriving in New York City and looking at it, and instead of concluding that there was a designer, that there was an architect, that it all happened as a result of an explosion, that at some time in the past, someone put some dynamite under the ground, blew it up, and you got, voila, New York City. Now that kind of a conclusion would be a conclusion in the mode of ignorance. So it is a symptom of the scientist being in the mode of ignorance, being addicted to women, intoxication, illicit sex, and gambling, that they come up with such an absurd, unreasonable type of a faith. The faith that everything came as a result of a Big Bang is unreasonable. The faith that everything was created by an infinitely intelligent supreme designer is reasonable. It is entirely reasonable. So there's faith and there's faith. So one owes it to himself to study everything very logically, very rationally, very reasonably, and then cultivate his faith. But without faith, you can't live. To say that one can live without faith is an absurdity. Everyone has to have faith. Every time you walk on the sidewalk, you walk in the faith that that manhole cover underneath your foot will not all of a sudden open up and have you fall down and break your head. You live on faith that every time it says walk and you cross the street, that you'll not be run down by an automobile. Everyone has to live by faith. You buy an airplane ticket, you take all your life savings, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, you go to some counter somewhere, you give all this money to a man in a uniform. He gives you a piece of paper, and on that piece of paper it says that you'll fly around the world in 30 days' time. Now that requires faith. You're giving all your life savings for a piece of paper. You have faith in the uniform, you have faith in the sign that says Pan Am, you have faith in the ticket because it says Pan Am. So similarly, what is required is faith in the Supreme Personality of Godhead as He is revealed through bona fide scriptures and not through some LSD phantasmagoria. That type of faith is called parampara, and that is the faith of the most intelligent, highly advanced, civilized man. When there are sometimes arguments in the courthouse, one lawyer says this, one lawyer says this, and they each cite various authorities, etc., etc., and there are different opinions, then sometimes one has to accept the final judgment of the greatest authority. There are groups who take Krishna as an ordinary man. There are groups that take Krishna as symbolic. There are those who take him as a mythical figure. But what is the decision of the author of the Bhagavad Gita himself? What is the opinion of the person about whom all this controversy revolves? He says, Avijananti mam mudha manusim tanumasvitan. He says, if people think that just because I have a human-like form, that I am a human being, that I am an ordinary human being, they are mudhas, they are asses, fools, and rascals. Parambhavma janatoma mabhuta maheshwaram. They do not know my transcendental nature and my supreme dominion over all that be. The speaker of the Bhagavad Gita himself condemns all these different schools of philosopher as asses. So if that's not an authoritative opinion, I don't know what is. This verse that we're discussing today, 17.2, is prefaced by the three words, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. Bhagavan means the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He who has all wealth, all strength, all fame, all knowledge, all beauty, and all renunciation. Anyone who has these six options is the one and only Supreme Personality of God, and it is he who is speaking here. And who is writing this? It is another incarnation of God, Mahamuni Kimva Paririshvaraha. It is also the Supreme Ishvara, the Supreme Controller, in his literary incarnation as Vyasadeva, who is writing down the Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita. So Vyasadeva, the literary incarnation of God, writes that these are the words of God. And then by his words, you understand that this could be none other than the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then final confirmation of this comes by your own purification. You'll never know God unless you're pure. He's pure, so you have to become pure to approach him. If you want to mix with fire, you have to become like fire. Ultimately, if one is not prepared to make the sacrifice, if after reading all these scriptural references and assimilating all the authoritative opinions of the acharyas, all of which confirm that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of God, if after all of that he's not willing to carry the experiment a little bit further and himself become purified, then all that he has studied beforehand will be of no avail and of no use for him. Simply logic and study without faith is dry, philosophical, useless, like eating dry cereal or something. On the other hand, blind faith without logic and reasoning and scriptural backing is fanaticism. What is required is both. The logic and reasoning have to be there. And then on the basis of logic and reasoning, one cultivates a reasonable faith. A reasonable faith in the words of Krishna that he is the Supreme, in the confirming opinion of Srila Vyasadeva, Asita, Narada, Devala, Vyasa, the four Kumaras. One abides by the decisions of these great acharyas, these philosophical, literary, ethical giants, all of whom at different times in history have delivered the concluding opinion, like the opinion of a Supreme Court judge, that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of God. If we abide by this decision, then that is called parampara. That is called disciplic succession. It is a firm decision of faith based on logic and reason. We are parts and parcels of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just like sparks from a fire. He's the big fire, we're sparks. Or drops of water from the ocean. Now, just because a drop of water tastes the same as the ocean doesn't mean that it is the ocean. This is the opinion of the Mayavadis, or the impersonalists. They say that because a drop of water tastes the same as the ocean, that it is the ocean. And they say, Tat Tvam Asi, I am that. I am that Supreme Personality of Godhead. I am God, you are God, we are all God. But if God is great, if God is like the big fire and we're like sparks from the fire, if God is like the ocean and we're like drops from the ocean, then there is a difference between ourselves and God. So far, knowledge is concerned. Our knowledge is proportionally small compared to the omnisciency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A particle of gold is not of the same value as a gold mine. Similarly, the knowledge that I deliver on the strength of my speculation or my whimsy has an insignificant amount of value compared to the knowledge which is delivered by that personality who is himself the absolute truth, who is the cause of all causes, the architect of both the material and the spiritual world. Who would be such a fool as to rely on his own speculation when he has available at hand scriptural texts written and spoken by the Supreme Personality of God? Who is such a fool that he would overlook these revelatory, absolutely infallible scriptures in order to pursue his own tiny analytical, empirical laboratory experiments? It's like a man who in full sunlight is trying to find a flashlight. The sunlight is already there, or maybe he lives by the bank of the Ganges and he's trying to dig a well. Why should he try to dig a well if he's living if five steps away is the Ganges? He can do everything. Wash his dishes, do laundry, everything he can do. But instead of that, he's building himself a well. So one has to doubt seriously the wisdom of modern-day theologians, philosophers, and scientists who try to explain this cosmic manifestation on the basis of their faith in their own senses. We know that our senses are defect. All the time we talk about optical illusions. We know our senses are tricky and devious. And yet they place all of the weight of their so-called scientific argument evident on the basis of their senses. So our knowledge is not of the same quality of knowledge as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The knowledge of subhumans who are addicted to animalistic activities is not going to help us. One has to purify his body so that he can be receptive to knowledge coming down from higher sources. This is called the descending process. The ascending process is that by which one tries to stretch his mind to encompass the unlimited Supreme Personality of Godhead. Certainly a fruitless task at best. But the descending process comes when one purifies himself sufficiently that he becomes like a transcendental receiver, and through the medium of the bona fide spiritual master in the scriptures, he becomes illumined by transcendental knowledge. The Supreme Lord is situated within the heart of every living being, and if one chants his name and purifies his heart, then the Lord is evident from within the heart, and one becomes illumined by transcendental knowledge. Everything becomes known, and nothing remains unknown for the perfectly purified devotee of the Lord.
You've been listening to commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita as it is. Bhagavad Gita is the essence of India's Vedic wisdom and one of the great spiritual and philosophical classics of the world. The ultimate conclusion of the Gita is unconditional loving surrender unto Lord Krishna, which frees one from all sins, bringing one to complete enlightenment and enables one to return to Krishna's eternal spiritual abode.